Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Marcy Hecker, a wildlife forensic scientist at the Smithsonian Institution's Feather Identification Lab in Washington, D.C. We'll talk about wildlife forensics, bird strikes and feather identification, and how her analyses help airports manage wildlife to enhance airline safety. We'll also talk about how she and the other forensic scientists at her lab helped analyze the crash of U.S. Airways Flight 1549, otherwise known as the Miracle on the Hudson. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound of a familiar and widespread large bird that has a black head and neck, white chin strap, and a light tan or cream-colored breast with a brown back. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Marcy Hecker, a wildlife forensic scientist. Marcy Hecker is a research assistant with the Smithsonian Institution's Feather Identification Lab in Washington, D.C. She received her Master's of Science and Bachelor's of Science in Biology from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. She also holds an associate's degree in veterinary technology from Columbus State College in Columbus, Ohio. The main focus of Marcy's work is in avian species identification from microscopic and whole feather characters. This specialized work in wildlife forensics is particularly important for aviation industry personnel that deal with civil and military bird strikes. This feather identification service has led to collaborations with scientists in the fields of aviation safety, wildlife biology, anthropology, and law enforcement. Marcy's current research is on the feather microstructure of the ducks, geese, and swans. Bird strikes, as we saw from the Miracle on the Hudson, have the potential to be extremely dangerous. While typically the result is not as catastrophic, birds and other wildlife strikes to aircraft annually cause over $600 million in damage to U.S. civil and military aviation each year. What the Smithsonian's Feather Identification Lab does is fundamental to deciding how to address those bird strikes. That's because the first thing you have to know to deal with them is what species are being hit. For instance, using the lab's identification of species that do the most damage to their aircraft, the U.S. Air Force Bird Wildlife Aircraft Strike Hazard Team, also known as BASH Team, gathers information about the habitats of commonly struck species, their breeding behavior, and migratory patterns. And then they created a dynamic map that shows bird strike risk levels across the United States. That helps pilots avoid flying in certain areas at certain times based on the concentrations of birds that are predicted to be there. The species identifications from the lab also help airport biologists manage the habitats in such a way so as to discourage wildlife from congregating in the area. While the methods will vary depending on each unique situation, it works. For example, JFK International Airport in New York has reduced the number of gull strikes by roughly 80% by using tactics such as grass management, eliminating standing water, and frightening birds with pyrotechnics. All that is possible once you know the species you're dealing with. When we spoke recently, I asked Marcy how she first got interested in wildlife forensics.
I kind of came into this job in a kind of an odd backwards way. Actually, this is second career for me, and I started out as a veterinary technician early on and worked as a vet tech. And you know, as you go through life, I went back and I knew I wanted to go back to school for my bachelor's. And I was kind of interested in forensics. And I've always loved lab work and that type of thing. So we were actually relocated to Washington, D.C. for my husband's job. And I went back to school. Still had forensics in mind, but my background was always in animals and wildlife. So I was just kind of going through school, trying to figure out how to make the two work together.
And at that time, was there a field of wildlife forensics?
There actually was, and I just didn't know about it. And I was very, very lucky. I always say I was in the right place at the right time. It really was. that my undergrad advisor asked me, he's like, if you could do anything in the world, what would you do? And I said, I'd like to do wildlife forensics. And he just rolled his eyes. He goes, oh my gosh, not another one. And I'm like, what?
There's and, more than one?
Yeah, and that exactly. I was like, what? Wait, you're the first person. And he ended up being a graduate advisor for our current lab director, Dr. Carla Dove.
Really?
And she was here at the Smithsonian, and she came up with both of our mentors, Roxy Laybourne, who kind of started our Feather ID Lab, and just kind of, you know, gave me contacts. So I just literally walked in off the street and introduced myself, and I actually started here in the bird division at the Feather ID Lab as a volunteer for about 3 years and continued my education, got my bachelor's in biology, and just kept sticking it out and really took to it. And I loved the lab work. And birds were actually new to me. I was more of a mammal person, so I had a lot to learn. But it just really worked out. And I'm just very lucky. And it was literally one of those, I was in the right place at the right time with the right interest.
When did the Feather Identification Lab, what is the formal name? It's Smithsonian's Feather Identification Laboratory?
Yeah, it's the Smithsonian Institution Feather Identification Lab. And we're housed in Washington, D.C. at the National Museum of Natural History. We're behind the scenes. If you think of the Natural History Museum, you know, kind of the public sees the exhibits. And we're actually behind the scenes in the collections area. And we're a part of the bird division. So the bird division houses all of the Smithsonian bird collections.
When did this lab start?
It actually started, like I say, with our mentor, Roxy Laybourne. And she started here at the Smithsonian, I think it was around 1944. And she was hired in as like a biological tech. She did a lot of taxidermy work and a lot of preparation of the specimens. And as time went on through the years, she did some work on plumage. You know, kind of being at the Smithsonian, you get approached with all kinds of different cases and people needing advice. And she ended up doing a couple of feather projects. One of them in the 60s happened to be an airplane that crashed in Boston that they had feathers in it, that it had hit a bird. And she worked that case. And then, you know, kind of as time went on, she got this reputation and experience. And the aviation industry, just by word of mouth, heard there's this person that could identify feathers. And so that went through the 70s, and in the 80s it started getting a little more formal, especially with like the Air Force. And Roxy did a lot of, she did a lot of law enforcement work too, with like fish and wildlife forensic work during that time, kind of the 70s and 80s, with, you know, poaching cases. She even worked a couple of law enforcement, like FBI cases. Then through the 80s and progressed. And by that time, Carla Dove had started working, kind of coming in behind Roxy. Kind of the same thing. She kind of took to it, and Roxy, pardon the pun, took her under her wing.
I like that.
And we consider the way we came in was very much like an apprenticeship, because the skill for the way we do IDs using morphology really does take quite a while to kind of get the eye for it. You know, like we say, 75% science and 25% art. So just kind of get the eye and the vision for looking at such small things. But so kind of a big turning point for this Feather ID Lab was in the 90s. It was about 1995, I believe. And it was an unfortunate case for the Air Force in Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska. Unfortunately, one of their aircraft hit a flock of geese on takeoff, and they lost all 24 people on board. So that was a big turning point for the Air Force. And that was when things started to get a little more formalized as far as requiring a feather identification service for bird strikes. And a bird strike is, if people don't know, it's when a bird strikes an aircraft. That's kind of the core of our work, is we identify these species that hit aircraft.
Regarding the apprenticeship, what you had said, there is no school mm-hmm. that teaches this. You really have to learn
no.
on the job.
Yeah. Roxy, like I say, started, and she started doing a lot of work with looking at feathers under the microscope. And there had been a few people very early on. There's Asa Chandler that was looking at feathers under the microscope. There's a good book, Lucas and Stettenheim, that they did a lot of microscopic feather work. And Roxy kind of built on that and using it in a practical application for the species ID, mainly for aviation. We're very specialized. There's only a handful of people in the world that do it. Our background for schooling, as Carla and I came in behind Carla, was we had, it's like you say, they don't teach it in school. So our schooling was just basic biology and wildlife biology. And our graduate degrees were very specific. Roxy was on Carla's graduate committee, and then after that, Carla was on my graduate committee. Nobody else knew what we were doing.
And the graduate degrees were also in wildlife biology?
They were in wildlife biology oriented. So Carla's, she started out with like wildlife management in bachelor's, and then her master's and PhD are in biology and environmental science. But her project was specifically on feather structure. And that's the feather microstructure and the little fluffy down part of the feather. And that kind of gives us clues to species. And it's very much akin to like trace evidence. People may be more familiar with from the human forensics, people that look at hairs and fibers. It's very similar to that. And then my schooling was undergrad with biology and master's in biology. But my thesis was on feather microstructure of waterfowl. So that was how we kept ourselves very specialized as far as schooling goes. But in the meantime, both Carla and I just did our time with Roxy and just learning by doing.
Going back to the lab, so in 1995, was that the formal?
That was kind of the big turning point when we started getting more formal agreement. Kind of started with the U.S. Air Force. And today, with, like I say, Carla's the program director today, we have interagency agreement with the U.S. Air Force, the FAA for civil aviation, and the U.S. Navy. But we are housed at the Smithsonian. We are Smithsonian employees, and it's an interagency agreement between all of those organizations.
So when any of those organizations have a case, then they just come right to you?
Yes, they do.
And how many cases do you get a year?
Currently, it's grown quite a bit. I've been working now coming up on 10 years. Back when I first started, probably doing 1,000 cases a year. And I believe last year we did close to 5,000 cases.
Really?
Yeah. And there's four of us in the lab now. The lab just keeps growing. Carla's the director, myself, and we have Jim Watton. We're both research assistants. And we do a lot of kind of whole feather ID and microscope. And kind of a real exciting thing for us is the past few years we've been doing DNA. We added DNA to our morphology IDs, and we have a genetic specialist, Farida Dillon. So there's four of us, and it's a lot of fun to kind of see how we all kind of blend together and to solve these cases. It's fun.
Are most of those cases bird strike cases?
They are. The majority, the vast, absolute majority of the casework we do are aviation bird strikes. Birds that hit aircraft.
So what are the different forms a bird strike can take? Is it always in the engine? Or?
It isn't always. The vast majority of them are non-damaging. They a lot of times they don't even know that they've hit one until they've landed and the maintenance personnel inspect the planes, especially for military. They definitely inspect those aircraft and the different mechanisms all on those aircraft too. And that's usually when they'll find them. They'll kind of find a smudge or maybe a few feathers, or you may not know, but there's actually wildlife biologists on major airfields.
Really?
And their job is to manage the wildlife on and around the airfield. And that's kind of, those would be our clients. Is our job is to kind of help them and give them the information of the species that are actually striking the planes or occurring on their airfield.
So are most of the cases that come in a problem where an airplane has crashed or where?
No. The vast majority, like I say, are non-damaging. It's more for documentation and like data trend analysis. You know, it kind of peaks. It's really amazing because our bird strikes actually, the numbers peak during migration, which makes sense when there's more activity and then fall migration, there's more birds. But no, the vast majority are what we consider non-damaging. They're for like data information purposes. You can go to help, you know, a wildlife biologist. They have to document all of their wildlife on their airfield. And, you know, they may have permit issues, but in order to do the permits, they have to know what species are involved, and that's where we would help out.
Why is it so important to know exactly which species are involved in the bird strike?
That's a really good question. Back in the day, we can talk to some of the older pilots, and they're like, oh, we used to just fly through them and just go through them and go on. And after a couple of kind of tragic incidences, and even something like Flight 1549 on the Hudson, really gets people's attention to the safety issue and the safety factor. In the aviation world, we fall under kind of the umbrella of flight safety. If you know what the problem is, which for us would be species, you know how to deal with the problem. And you can document the problem and then go on to assess and mitigate and try to analyze how to manage it. It's very much like a wildlife management issue. And so our little part at the very beginning is you have to know what species are being struck to get down, you know, in a good analysis down the road for like mitigation and management.
So different airports have different types of species that are problems?
They are. If you think from a biology standpoint, you know, I always consider every airfield is different. Every airfield has their own issues. If you think about it, you know, these airfields are just wonderful flat grasslands. And our species tend to, that are struck are kind of logically bird species that tend to love to hang out on grassland or, you know, hunt grassland species for like the raptors and whatnot.
I was just about to ask, so what are some of the common species that are struck or that are...
Some of the most common, and like I say, a lot of them are what we consider non-damaging cases, are things like mourning doves and swallows and horned larks, killdeer, savannah sparrows. Like I say, if you start to think about it, it's very much the species that just love these open grasslands. That's the most common. Now, if you want to kind of look at it a little differently, the most damaging, which could be anything from a hole in the wing or a bird going into an engine and they have to tear the engine down, or even from civil, it's interesting, we include downtime of the aircraft. If you think in the civil aviation world, you know, they just have to turn over these aircraft and they can have hundreds of people on a civil flight, is downtime can be extremely costly. And I believe one of the last numbers I heard was for civil aviation, bird strikes and wildlife strikes, they're estimating, it's an estimate, about $600 million a year lost.
$600 million?
Yes. And the majority of that is downtime or damage to the aircraft.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's, you know, the number one issue for bird strikes is safety, because hands down, you know, we want to keep people safe. And the secondary is, to be honest, is a money issue, is to reduce the damage costs and downtime. Definitely, it's an interesting aspect of, like, wildlife management and, like, human-wildlife interaction.
Wow, because you don't really think of the costs involved in bird
strikes.
Yeah,
you don't. Yeah, you don't. And it could be anything, you know, if a civil aircraft takes off and maybe, unfortunately, they might hit a vulture on the way out and the pilot knows it. It's a big bird. For safety's sake, the pilot may make the decision to turn around and land, but he may have to dump fuel. So then they lose all that fuel. They've got a plane full of people. So then they have to, you know, make arrangements for all those people. Quite costly.
Do they attract birds because they are these open grasslands? Are
they actually
sort
can.
Of a magnet?
they actually can. And I heard a good description, you know, because a lot of us started in conservation work and we all love wildlife. And, you know, if you think about your backyard, if you want to attract animals to your backyard, you know, you always provide food, water, and shelter. And for our work, for managing wildlife on airports, it's almost the opposite. It's like, no, we want to keep the birds off of the airfields. So you have to look, where is the food, water, and shelter, and get rid of it. There's a lot of environmental mitigation that goes on. So, and that's kind of where we come in for species ID, is if we are constantly providing species ID for a biologist on an airfield. And over time, he can kind of track his trends. And if all of a sudden he notices that he's getting a certain herons at the end of one of his runways, he can go down there, and if there's, maybe a ditch filled with water or a wetlands, they can do environmental mitigation, maybe get rid of the wetlands. Or depending on their species, maybe they can mow the grass shorter or maybe keep the grass longer. It just depends on what their species problem is. And that would be where we come in, is we help provide them with the species information.
Can we walk through a case?
Sure.
And tell me, so what happens, how does a case work? When are you first notified?
We actually receive everything every day. We never know what we're going to get. It makes it kind of fun. And we can receive, probably an average of 20 a day. During migration, we can get 100 a day. And every case is different. And for us, for identification, it totally depends on what kind of material we get.
What kinds of material do you get?
We get the full gamut. It can be anything from a whole frozen carcass to a partial carcass, maybe a piece of a wing or a piece of a body to just a bunch of feathers that maybe they found kind of stuck into the seams on an aircraft. Or sometimes if they have a whole bird, they'll just pluck some feathers and send to us. And now that over time they've learned how to get better and better and better at collecting, and with us doing DNA, now they're doing, we call them like paper towel swipe. And these are just like smudges on the airplane, maybe a blood smudge. Unfortunately, it's kind of where a bird hits and they almost skip off of the airplane to where there's just kind of a mark left. And we kind of call that material snarge, bird snarge. But we get that quite a bit too. And especially for some of the sensitive military planes, where they really go over those aircraft with a fine-tooth comb, and we'll get that stuff, too. And so the way we approach an ID totally depends on the material we get.
After every flight, is someone examining the aircraft, or only with...
Most of the time for military, not so much for civil, unless they see something obvious or the pilot notes something obvious.
Does a report, some sort of report, accompany the material?
It does. The Air Force has an online bird strike reporting system, and the civil aviation has developed now a very good online bird strike reporting system also. And it's really great for compiling data. We actually have access to it, so we can enter our identifications directly online, and it goes straight back to the person in the field. It's really nice.
So the material comes in, and
right.
So where does it go? Or does it? It depends what type of material it is.
It does. So when we get the material, first thing we do is we just kind of open it up. We read the report. It's almost kind of like a triage. We're looking at this case. How are we going to work this case? And the way we do identifications is we kind of have three tools in our toolbox. The first one is kind of term it as whole feathers. And the whole feathers is what it is. It's going to be whole feathers. They have obvious color and pattern. There's enough material that we actually take it out into the collections of the bird division. And we have about the third largest bird collections in the world here. So we have these vast aisles of specimens that we can actually directly take the feather and compare it to a specimen. So we're not just doing this by memory. A lot of it is memory and experience.
So you might know from the color, the size,
right,
the shape.
Right. Like I actually have a case here I just opened right before you called, and I'm looking at it. It has very good whole feather material. They did a good job collecting. I've got a good report here. And just through experience, and it's kind of funny, it's almost like birding. The people that go out and birdwatch, I look at size, I look at color, we look at pattern, does it have a spot or does it have a streak? And then just with our experience, we start to narrow it down. And the report is very important for us, the information from the field. And if you think about birds, or anybody that's interested in birds, that's why we would need time of year and location. Because of how birds ebb and flow during the year, they can migrate. Some of them might be in one area in the summer, but they're not there in the winter. So you have to really know your bird. I also walk around with my bird guide in my hand every day. So, I try to remember most of it, but I use my bird guides quite a bit too.
Can you give an example where one type of feather that's, you know, a certain size or a certain color and shape, in one time of the year, it would lead you to think it's one species, and another time of the year, it would lead you to think it's another?
Oh, sure. You know, a really good one are like some of the tanagers can change from summer to winter, from something bright red to something kind of yellow-green. Or from age, even if it's like a first-year male, may look like a greenish-yellow female, but after a couple of years, it'll be a bright, nice bright red. The other thing would be, like in gulls, they kind of get a little bit of brown kind of speckling sometimes in the winter. And, you know, different ages, different sexes, you know, a female mallard versus a male mallard. We have to keep all those things in mind. So the whole feather, like I said, kind of going back to our three tools, with the whole feather being our first tool, and that's actually going out comparing feathers. Whole feathers are feather pieces with the collections.
So the bird collections act as
they are our reference collection. And that is, to us, is very important, because you don't want to, you know, we are comparing to a vouchered specimen. And in the museum world, as it should be with a lot of forensic labs, is we can actually prove it. I can actually pull a specimen, similar date, similar time, similar location, and physically compare it. So, you know, kind of in the museum world, a vouchered reference specimen is very, very, very important.
So it's been
verified. You're only as good as your reference collection. Yeah. And that kind of carries over into other forensic labs, too. You know, they have extensive, no matter what they're working on, you know, they all have extensive reference collections of known samples.
Do others use your reference collection of birds?
Oh, in the bird collection, it was actually established. It's research-based. And if you think, our collections here at the Smithsonian actually started before airplanes were invented.
Really?
Yeah, and that's when it started. We're coming up on the Smithsonian's 100th anniversary. And kind of funny, I can go out and use a specimen that was actually dated before airplanes were invented. It's ironic, but it's kind of exciting for the collections because... And the importance of the collections, of who knows what the future is going to hold for these collections and how valuable they can be. But we're just a small part of the bird division. Most of the bird division is research-oriented for ornithology research.
While we're on the subject of the whole feathers,
yeah.
Can you tell me about the feathers themselves? What are the main parts of a feather?
That's a good question, because it's actually kind of important for us, which will lead into our second tool, which is the microscope. So when you look at a feather, the part that you see on the bird, and it's usually the top part, or we call it the distal part, and it's the part that's going to have the color and pattern, and the microstructure of that region for basically all birds is all the same. And it looks like little hooklets, and that's how the feathers kind of hold themselves together, where the hooklet on one little barb kind of reaches over and grabs onto the other side. It's really interesting, but for our casework, unfortunately, that distal part with those hooklets doesn't help us for identification. It all looks the same.
So what do you use?
What we like is the little fluffy downy part at the base of the feather. It's called the proximal part. That's the part that we look at under the microscope for different characters.
So that's some unique trait to that group or family of birds.
It's amazing that the little fluffy downy part under the microscope actually has different characters on it.
For
really? Different groups. Yeah, for different groups. Now, it is a little limited. You can't get to species. You can get to groups. So I wouldn't be able to tell you just on microstructure. I wouldn't be able to tell you it was a mallard, but I could tell you it was a dabbling duck.
Okay. So you'd know it was an eagle.
We could get it to eagle. And this is where, like, the location and the date and the circumstantial evidence kind of helps us. And one of our big ones that we use a lot is in bird strikes, we see chimney swifts a lot. If you think about their habits and, you know, they're out there kind of feeding around the airfields, they have pretty fairly unique microstructure. And we always look, if it's on the east coast of the United States, we'll go ahead and call that a chimney swift. Even on under the microscope, it looks like a swift, but the location, we know it's going to be a chimney swift. There's no other swift, let's say in Virginia, where I am. If it's on the West Coast, I would hold that ID back and just call it a swift, because there's more swifts out west. Like in Washington State, for example, I wouldn't be able to tell if it was a vose or a white-throated versus a chimney. So there are some limits to microstructure, but it's still very valuable information for the biologist on the airfield. If we tell them it's a duck, it's helpful for them to know that it was maybe either a migrating duck or maybe a duck. You know how they love to put beautiful ponds out in landscaping out in airports?
Right.
You know, is it a duck from, you know, the landscaping pond versus a pigeon that may be roosting up in some hangars? From the whole feather standpoint, we start almost like looking at a bird, size, shape, color, go out and directly compare it to the specimens in our collection. The microstructure, even if, let's say I had whole feathers that they just weren't ringing a bell to me, I didn't quite know where to start, I'll come in all the time and I'll make a quick microslide and I'll be like, oh gosh, yeah, I'm looking at a rail. And then that'll get my brain going, and then I'll go back out to the collection and start narrowing down the rails.
So how does that microstructure change? What does it look like? Say, what does a swift or a chimney swift look like?
It's beautiful. They're so beautiful. Sometimes they look like modern art, I think. A lot of people say they remind them of plant material almost. If you think about a feather, I'll kind of give you an idea of the level that we're looking on. So you have a whole feather, and a whole feather is made up of feather barbs. So that's all those single, they almost look like Christmas trees, kind of coming off the central shaft.
So those are the fluffy parts that...
Right.
When you think feather, that's really what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
it's a group of barbs that are run along that central shaft. Well, if you go one more step, if you pulled one barb off and looked at it, it almost looks like a Christmas tree. And the little shoots that are coming off of the barb are called barbules. And that's what we look at, that third level down. If we get that under just basic light microscopy, kind of, you know, we all learned it in high school and college. We look usually from about 100 magnification to 400. And we actually look at the barbules. And on that barbule level, there's different pigment. Like there may be little dots. They look like little beads that run along these barbules. They have these structures we call nodes that can have different shapes. Some of them, like ducks, look like big pyramids. Pigeons kind of have almost like a crocus shape. Some of the nodes are really big, only out at the very tips, and then the rest of the barbule smooth. And it's just vast different variations. And that's a lot where the experience comes in, of just learning these combination of characters and how they would look. It's really interesting stuff.
So if someone finds a feather in their yard, they could actually do this at home or in a science class or in a science...
You could, and actually it'd be a great thing for a science class. You know, just it's basic microscopy, make a slide. If just for basic, you could almost put a drop of water. We use some other mounting chemicals, and just look at like 100x, maybe 200x. Just keep in mind, a feather is made up of barbs, and barbs are made up of barbules, and you're going down to that third barbule.
Do you compare it again to a reference specimen?
We do. Barbules? Yeah, that's a real good question, and it goes back to what I said about the whole feathers for a reference collection. Back when Roxy was here, she started a microslide reference collection of known feathers. I would imagine that we probably have the largest collection of feather slides in the world, a little over 2,000 samples. And we have this great microscope where you can look at two things at the same time. You can put them side by side, so we can put an unknown on one side and put our known reference slides on the other and look at them both at the same time and kind of match things up. But feather, you know, feather microstructure, Roxy used to always say they keep you honest, and they really do. Just when you think, you know, they'll kind of come and poke you every once in a while. And the reason is because there's variation.
So how does it vary within the bird? you know, if it's a body versus wing?
It can vary from what part of the bird. Like our reference collections and for our graduate work, our microscopic standards are from breast feathers.
Why is that?
They generally have very good characters. I tend to call them robust. But if you would go out like onto a wing or down on a leg, the microstructure just starts to almost kind of fade out into nothing, into just little prongs. And what they tend to do, even if you start at the bottom of a whole feather, in the fluffy part, you can get beautiful microstructure, just these beautiful nodes and pigment. And if you start working your way up the feather, they slowly transition into those hooklets. Remember the hooklets out at the distal part? It looks a lot like Velcro. It goes from these beautiful nodes of the down, and as you move your way slowly up the feather, it transitions into the hooklets. And up in that region, there's no variation. The purpose of those hooklets is so strong for flight and protection that all birds basically look the same in that region.
But if you had the whole feather, a wing or tail might vary more in terms of color.
It does, yeah. So I probably wouldn't need to go there. Or, you know, just with our experience, we can get pretty good at spotting the good stuff. Like we get pretty good at looking for little teeny tiny feather barbs.
And then that microstructure, it varies based on where on the bird.
But where also on the bird and where on the feather.
So where on the bird, where on the feather.
Yeah.
What about within the same species, like juveniles or males and females?
Oh, yeah, good question. Juveniles, like kind of, and like fledglings and first plumage birds, their microstructure is just not quite as developed. We haven't done too much work with it, but it's enough that you can notice it. But if you go within a species, they all look the same. So a female mallard looks exactly the same as a male mallard. Like I said, it would look similar to another dabbling duck. It would look similar to a pintail. And that's how the microstructure kind of limits us to group. A little limited, but still very useful.
And so to get to species, you had said that there were three tools in your toolbox.
Three tools. And so our third big tool, which is really exciting for us, and is the DNA analysis. We've been up and running now, I think, for about 3 years. That's just opened up a whole new world and really improved the level of our IDs. And particularly, remember, like I said, they're kind of just wiping that snargy kind of smudges off. You know, back 5 years ago, maybe all we could tell them was that it was some kind of passerine. Well, now we'll sample that and are getting really good results for species level using DNA.
Now, can DNA always be recovered? And is it contained in the feathers themselves?
Oh, boy, that's kind of two questions. And if you think of the material we get, and this is kind of the challenge, is we don't know what we're going to get. This is material from these poor, unfortunate birds that have struck planes, and we're talking about carcass material. It's not fresh. A lot of times, you know, like I said, the good microstructures at the base of usually the body. Well, what if we don't have any body feathers? And that's the same for DNA once an organism dies, the DNA starts to degrade and break down. There are a lot of times that we cannot get any viable DNA out of these samples. Can be a number of reasons. Just normal degradation, like if maybe the carcass was sitting around for a long time. We use kind of a one-pass try at DNA. We don't really, you know, there's lab methods that we could sit there and really work at it. But if it's just a typical routine case, we just kind of do a one-pass DNA analysis. It's quite possible that there was nothing in the sample, you know, no bird material in the sample to begin with. You know, if it was an insect or some other smudge that they have collected. So there's a number of reasons for, you know, possibly not getting an answer with DNA. And then we would back off and we would do the feather microstructure to at least get a level of answers. Right now we're running about, you know, like I say, we do about 5,000 cases a year, and we're running about 90% of our IDs are to species level.
And that's through a combination of all three methods?
Through a combination. And that's, for me, you know, I started out, I'm a morphologist, and started out before we did DNA. And, you know, Carla kind of took me kicking and screaming into the DNA molecular world, and now I just love it. And one of my favorite things is how we end up working, doing more than one method of those three tools. And it's a great quality control. So if I feel one of my whole feather IDs, if, you know, I just want to confirm that, I can sample it and send it to Farida for DNA. And likewise, we'll pull some random DNA cases and go check the microstructure for quality control that way too.
And so DNA can be recovered from a feather. Is that right?
It can. A lot of time we're looking for tissue for sampling. Like if we get a sample on an alcohol wipe, first thing if it's available, we'll go for the tissue or blood. But in a lot of cases, we do just have feathers. And hopefully if someone plucks the feather, what we'll go for is right where the feather inserts into the skin. And we're going for, there's usually little tissue tags at the end of that. It's a lot like hair. You can't really get DNA from the hair, but if you go down to the root, where the root inserted into the skin, you can get DNA from there.
So I know your lab has developed a bird DNA library that's mapped the genetic code of 96% of U.S. and Canadian bird species, or maybe that's higher now.
Yes, it's still about 96%. And, you know, I have to give credit. That's a very good point. Remember, I keep coming back to you're only as good as your reference collection. And so we have whole birds here in the bird division. We have our microscope slide collection. And what we decided to use for our DNA reference is a group from Guelph, University of Guelph, and it's called the Barcode of Life Database, BOLD, B-O-L-D. They have a really good website. I encourage people to look at it. It's really exciting. It's worldwide. And the goal of this is we look at one piece of one specific gene. And the purpose is for identification purposes. It's not really used for like taxonomic studies or phylogenetic studies, but we're finding it's working really well for just these real straightforward species IDs. It's an online database. We do the extraction of the DNA here, the PCR, which is where you make a whole bunch of copies of the DNA. Very specific. And remember, we're looking just for a very specific gene. And the sequencing is done here through the Smithsonian genetic labs. And the sequencing is when you get that big long list of the ACTGs, the nucleotide sequence. And so Farida does all of this online. She'll get the sequence with a case number, and she actually copies that sequence into the BOLD search database. So BOLD is up in Canada at Guelph. And that's how we will get our matching species.
So then you're comparing it again, still the like-to-like.
A reference database, yeah. And we feel very strongly about having vouchered references. And, you know, there's always discussion of possibly sampling a bird when you band it and then you let the bird go. It's good, but we're trying to strive for at least a certain number of documented vouchered specimens for that reference database. And so far, it's going really well. For our purposes, for identification, the Barcode of Life is working really well for us.
Now, I'd be remiss not to ask you about the case of the, you know, U.S. Airways flight 1549, the miracle on the Hudson.
The miracle on the Hudson, yeah.
And your lab worked on that case.
We did. Yeah, we did.
So take us through it. And, you know, what did your lab determine and how has that changed? You know, what happened with the findings?
We initially heard about it right away, just through our colleagues. We knew it was going to come in. It was just a matter of time. For that case, I believe our initial contact was through the USDA. The USDA Wildlife Services does a lot of airport wildlife mitigation work. They're kind of an important part of our clients. And I believe that was the first people we talked to. They said they were heading out there to sample. And we told them we were ready, whatever we could do for them. And that quickly changed to the NTSB. You know, as soon as they contacted us.
And that's the National Transportation Safety Board.
Yes. And that's the organization that actually does the investigation. And at that point, when they step in, that's who you answer to. That's who's in charge of the investigation.
And did they know away it was a bird strike?
Oh, yes, they did. And they actually were pretty sure it was geese because the pilot and co-pilot saw it and heard it and believed it was geese at the time. So once, you know, they landed and it took a while to get the aircraft back up out of the river, and one of the engines was on the bottom of the river. So it took us some time, and they began taking samples there in New York once they got the engines up.
And was the material really degraded because it had been in the water?
As you know, it was really amazing. There was quite a bit of material inside those engines. And really, I don't know if we kind of chuckle if it's the Hudson River. Oh, my gosh, it had a good aroma to it. So we started kind of the way you have to think about jet engines is they're a series of fan blades, one behind another, behind another, behind another, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller as you go to the back of the engine. And that's the way they tear apart those engines. They start at the front and just start pulling off each stage. And what they did is they collected material as they were breaking down that engine from the front to the back. So we started getting, I believe we probably got 4 shipments at least of samples as they just were continually tearing apart these engines. They immediately collected some, like I say, there in New York and got those to us. And then the engines went to Cincinnati to the GE, General Electric engine manufacturer. We work with engine manufacturers quite a bit. And that's where they tore down the engines and did even more collecting of material. And my understanding is at the very back of both of those engines, there was quite a bit of bird material back there. Hmm. So obviously, you know, at that time, it was such an amazing, huge event, you know, quite a lot of media attention, and the samples were coming in. If you think a normal sample for us, like a non-damaging sample, we'll get like one sample. If it's a whole feather case, we can probably work it in an hour, maybe 2 hours, and that includes the paperwork, and that's one sample. If we do DNA, we do one extraction. For the total Hudson River case, it was one of the largest cases we've ever worked on. We received 69 different samples. Out of those 69 samples, and they were everything from just a little wipe on a cotton swab to the next bag might have just pieces of feather and dirt and oil, and they were burned, to whole feathers that we could actually take out to the collection. Even at one point, they sent us like a piece of something from the wing, an engine part or something. So it was quite a variety of material. So anyway, out of those 69 samples that we received, 20 of those had enough whole feather material that we could confirm goose. And let me kind of backtrack of for the NTSB what our job was. They already had an idea from the pilots that it was geese. Obviously, and we hear it a lot from pilots, is they kind of seem it happen so fast that they might get it right. A lot of times they don't get the species right because it just happens so fast. And they have their job to do. So our number one job was to confirm the species. They thought it was a Canada goose. There's a very similar bird up there called the brant or brant goose, or a lot of times cormorants in flight can kind of look similar to geese. So that was our number one job, was to confirm it was Canada goose. Our second job, and we do this a lot for the more severe cases and accident investigations, is to help recreate, help the investigators recreate the accident and the specifics. Impact points. If after a crash, when they start kind of rebuilding and recreating the accident, can you confirm, did a bird hit here? Did it hit here? Did it go into the engine? If we try our best to do number of individuals, that's a little difficult for us since some of those DNA are very detailed DNA techniques. And the final question was, could we tell if those were migrant geese or resident geese, which for the Canada goose issue is kind of different, too.
Oh, interesting. So you really had
three different jobs that we had to do. So the first one is our specialty. We just literally dove into that, and all four of us worked together. It was a really exciting case. So out of the 69 samples we received, we had 20 samples had whole feather material that we actually could really look at. Five of those we could confirm were Canada goose. The other 15, we could only say it was some type of Branta species. We could not rule out that other Branta species, the brant goose, which looks very similar to a Canada goose.
Okay.
And remember, some of our IDs are limited, and we have to be very literal with the limits of how far we can go. But we had already confirmed that, yes, Canada goose is in this batch of samples. So 20 whole feather we did, and it's amazing to think of. On a normal non-damaging case, we may make maybe one slide to look at under the microscope. For Hudson River, we did 78 slides.
78 slides.
Yeah, it was, that's huge for, you know, if you think we normally maybe do one for a normal non-damaging case. Out of those 78 slides, 54 of them confirmed Branta species. Now remember, we have to hold it there.
So you couldn't go to Canada goose, but...
To Canada goose, but it was Branta. So we're already, you know, we're with the whole feathers at this point. We were in, by our standards, pretty confident it was Canada goose. And then the big one, if you think of a normal non-damaging case, a lot of times we don't do DNA, do one extraction. And like I say, if we do so much volume for efficiency and cost, we'll do one extraction, push it through the DNA lab one time. For the Hudson River case, we did 91 extractions, and 26 of those did confirm Canada goose. Now remember, each sample is labeled with the location on the aircraft where it was taken. So we're already starting to confirm geese in both engines.
Okay, so you were able to...
Right, so that kind of goes in, you know, we've already done step one, we've confirmed that it was Canada goose. Step two was to help actually recreate the specifics of what exactly happened. So then we're starting to confirm that, yes, there's Canada goose material in both engines, as well as there was some on the wing also. So to try to even go more specific, for Rita, did some DNA sexing. For that, it's kind of a straight, there's either going to be female material there or male. It was in one engine. We did confirm there was at least one male and at least one female. So they call that like minimum number of individuals. So we could confirm at least two birds went into one engine. The second engine, we could confirm it was male. Now, we don't know if it was more than one male, so we know at least one went into the other engine.
So now we're up to at least three.
At least three, and we know there were other impact points, non-catastrophic, that like hit the wing, and I believe one hit the tail also. But the engines was obviously the focus for the NTSB. The engine manufacturers have a lot of experience with bird strikes too, and they can actually look at the fan blades, and they have clues there for like the central impact on the fan blades. So they took our information with their information and combined that. Hmm. So it really, it was just an amazing case, and just very thankful that, just amazing that these guys landed this plane. Because literally, those birds went straight down the engines.
Has the engine design changed, or is that still being worked on? Or
still being worked on. Engines, and actually our historic bird strike IDs are used for this type of work, is engines go through certifications for things like hail damage, lightning, wind shear, and these engines have to be able to withstand these forces. But a lot of people don't know that they're actually certified to take birds.
Hmm.
Currently, the majority of the aircraft are certified for 4-pound. The engine can take a 4-pound bird and still maintain the structure. And the other thing for civil aviation is this aircraft can fly with one engine. So the interesting thing was, you know, the average weight for a Canada Goose can be around 8 pounds. So if it's certified for 4, and they took 2 8-pound birds in one engine and at least 1 8-pound in the other, it was just catastrophic for the engine. And that's a lot of discussion that came out in the NTSB report. The NTSB has filed their final recommendations, and that can be found on their NTSB website. It's pretty interesting. There's going to be, you know, repercussions from the Hudson River for a while.
So based on those findings, things might change in terms of engine design or how one manages at the that airport.
Right. And you know, there are established standards for wildlife control on and around the airfields. But once you get off of the airfield property, you know, they are living organisms, and they fly and they move and they change and they learn. And, you know, it's, you know, to me, this is amazing, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a really interesting case. I'm glad everything went okay.
Appreciate your taking the time to talk with me about all of this. It's been really interesting.
Sure. I mean, I'm really happy to talk to you about it. We have a really great job, and just being at the Smithsonian is amazing. And, you know, occasionally we get to go out and play and work on other feather IDs that are not bird strikes. Being at the Smithsonian, we can do anthropology artifacts or prey remain studies or food contaminants. We never quite know what's going to walk in our door.
Well,
as long as it's a feather.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about wildlife forensics, bird strikes, and feather identification with Marcy Hecker, a research assistant with the Smithsonian Institution's Feather Identification Lab in Washington, D.C. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of a familiar and widespread large bird that has a black head and neck, white chin strap, light tan or cream-colored breast, and a brown back. We've even talked about them a little bit today. It's the sound of Canada geese. You may recall that Canada geese were the subject of the 1996 film Fly Away Home, starring Jeff Daniels. Canada geese are big water birds with long necks, large bodies, large webbed feet, and wide, flat bills. They feed by dabbling in the water or grazing in fields or on lawns. You can often see them in flight, moving either in pairs or flocks. When you'll see them in flocks, they assume a V formation. Listen to the sound of Canada geese. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.